From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is Rick Pantaleo, science reporter in VOA's English division and author of the popular Science World blog, which you can find at voanews.com. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Amy Webb, futurist, author, founder, and CEO of Webb Media Group. That's a digital strategy consulting firm that researches near future trends in digital media and technology. Amy Webb is the author of two books, How to Make J-School Matter Again, A Blueprint for the Future of Education, and Data, A Love Story. A forthcoming book entitled How Did We Miss That? Is to be released later this year in the fall of 2016. She has also published many articles relating to future technologies and trends. Amy Webb lectures at Columbia University in New York City. She's a David Letterman Distinguished Professional Lecturer at Ball State University in the state of Indiana and was a visiting Nieman Fellow at Harvard University. Amy Webb is also a member of the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences and is on the board of directors of the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra. And Amy Webb joins us by phone from her office in Baltimore. Amy Webb, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I'm delighted to welcome my colleague, Rick Pantaleo.
Hi, Carol. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Rick.
And Rick's our very own in-house science and technology guru. Well, Amy, let me ask you, now that we've entered 2016, what do you think are the most striking technological trends on the horizon in this coming year?
Every year, at the end of the year, we release a report to the public. So that came out last month. And this time around, we had 81 trends, which was the biggest yet. And we've got a lot of questions as to why so many. And I think that if there was one trend to rule them all, the reason that we have so many trends is because for the first time in history, technology really has permeated everything that we do. It intersects with everything, whether that's education or health or charitable giving. Basically, nothing that happens anymore without technology somehow intersecting.
When you're talking about trends, what do you mean by a trend?
That's a great question, Rick. So trends for me are not things that are trendy. So in our case, we are looking at the emergence of things that fundamentally change human behavior or leverage human behavior in a new way. And we have a pretty detailed methodology that we use to identify what those trends are. So some of the trends from our report and the things that I'll be paying attention to in the coming year, they don't sound particularly exciting, although they are very, very important. So things like natural language generation, which probably doesn't sound very trendy, but it's actually quite significant. It'll impact a global audience. So a good example of that is actually the BBC, which just released a new tool that automatically generates multiple languages for stories that are published, and it does that using audio. So you can click on a story, for example, and you know that story may originally have been recorded in English, but it will self-generate a feed in multiple different languages. You know, we're also seeing natural language generation in other areas of the media. For example, the Associated Press, Yahoo, they're partnering with companies that will take data and run that data through an algorithm, and it will generate a story that sounds as though it was written by a human being. So natural language generation may not sound super exciting, but in reality, most people around the world who are connected to the internet will be affected by that sometime in the coming year.
When you're talking about technology, are we talking specifically about the internet?
No. You know, the internet is a big term. The thing that's fascinating about the internet that most people don't realize is that when you search Google or Bing or, you know, whatever engine you might use, you're really only accessing about 2% of what's actually out there. There's so many other kinds of things that use internet protocols in order to transfer from place to place or person to machine. There's a lot more information that sort of moves around that people don't realize. But we're also talking about wearable devices like connected watches, mobile phones. There are machines that are connected to each other.
Internet of Things.
The Internet of Things. There's also the Internet of X. And so, you know, this is pretty cool. There's a company that has built a scanner. And if you're somebody who has to take a lot of pills. My dad has to take lots of medicine every day, and a lot of those pills look similar. This scanner would allow you to scan the pill, and then it connects sort of the pill to the internet, and it will connect you to a database and tell you not only what that pill is, but it will tell you what the chemical compounds are in that pill, and it will help you understand whether or not that pill's been counterfeited, whether or not you can trust it. So not only will we be able to search for things digitally, but we'll be able to search things that are in the real world online, which is sort of mind-blowing if you think about it.
Amy, we have become so dependent on the internet, and from what you're saying, it looks like we're going to be even more dependent on the internet to get by in daily life. So the glaring question is, what about issues such as security and privacy?
Those are both important issues, and unless you've taken significant measures, it will become increasingly difficult to have any sense of being anonymous. And part of that is because of convenience. So in exchange for being able to upload your photos to Facebook and to have Facebook suggest tags, you know, which it does in every language all over the planet, that's convenient, that's helpful, it's sort of nice. But there's a reason that Facebook's able to do that, and that has to do with an algorithm that's able to process face recognition. In essence, what that means is that we have trained these systems to recognize our faces. Now, that may not sound like a big deal. There are things that we do that seem quite innocuous, like posting a photo of our kid at her birthday party. That can have long-term ramifications. On the flip side of that, data and privacy is a hot topic, especially in the EU right now. There are regulations that are set to go into effect, I think, in 2017 regarding what companies can do with your data, what data they're allowed to look at. You know, and that was really meant to safeguard data and to prevent people from infringing on your privacy and security. But the challenge in implementing that is that by the time it comes around, most of what's there will be obviated by brand new technology that launched again. So this is the central challenge for people who watch technology and who must regulate it.
We'll take a short break. We'll be right back.
One of the world's great cities, the gateway to America for generations. VOA brings you New York in 12 rarely seen views, presenting the 2016 VOA calendar, a gift from us, free for the asking. Just send us your mailing address in an email to calendar@voanews.com, and you can have New York's beauty grace your wall all next year.
Welcome back to Press Conference USA. Our guest is Amy Webb, founder and CEO of Webb Media Group. That's a digital strategy consulting firm that researches near-future trends in digital media and technology. Well, Amy Webb, we were talking about the tension between privacy and the internet. And, of course, we recall you wrote an article about the so-called use of facial recognition, and you said that within about 5 years, our faces will replace our passwords. Talk about progress in that regard and if that's a positive or a potentially negative trend.
So MasterCard is already experimenting with what they call selfie scans. So you could connect your credit card to your mobile phone. You could use your mobile phone then to make transactions, to check in on your account. The way that you would be authenticated is not with a password, which we all know are problematic because every month or so somebody's website gets hacked and somebody's database gets hacked and our passwords, you know, are compromised. So the idea here is that they would use a facial recognition algorithm and scan your face. Now, the challenge with this is that in a lot of ways our faces are just as hackable as our passwords. The key difference is that while you can change a password, you can't change your face, right?
Yeah, but there's such a thing called Photoshop, too.
There's also such a thing as Photoshop. You know, I have had some friends try to trick the technology and hold up a photo, for example. You know, one of the interesting things about these algorithms is that human faces have tens of thousands of micro expressions, and the algorithms are pretty smart. They not only recognize that it's us, right, but it's looking for unique identifiers, which is how, for example, if you have identical twins, theoretically this technology can tell the difference between the two. Now, I think that we do need better solution to passwords than asking people to type in, you know, their information, partially because most people are still using ridiculously easy passwords.
So they can remember them.
And remember them, yeah. I mean, exactly. As silly as this sounds, the most popular password is still,
password.
That is around the entire world, or something like password 1234. Common sense would dictate that you need to have a very difficult password to crack, that you need to change it every week. But you know, the practical realities of sort of being a digital citizen is that, you know, that's kind of a pain in the neck. If you're using the internet with any regularity, you know, you probably have somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 passwords that you have to remember. So to have a unique password for each one of those places and to change it a few times a week or once a week, you know, that becomes really challenging, which is why biometric scanning, like your fingerprint, or I've seen a patent filed that would require you to scan your fingerprint and then sort of move your phone around in the air, like in a certain pattern that you would make up. Combinations like that are scanning your iris, scanning your face. These are next generation alternatives, although I don't know that they're necessarily that much better.
Just a quick follow-up, Amy. You said in a previous article that the millennial generation is probably one of the most surveilled generations, that they really have, again, against their own will, they don't have much privacy because their parents have taken pictures of them and uploaded them indiscriminately on Facebook or whatever. What are the implications of that?
So I probably think about this much more than the average person because of what I do for a living. I'm thinking like 10 to 15 years from now, 20 years from now, maybe even longer, I foresee a time in which you will have no option to be anonymous. And in fact, anonymity will be the mark of a well-educated, well-off class of people who can afford to have their identities erased from servers that are connecting people to data that's online. You know, why does that matter? Well, we may be, you know, in a situation a decade or more from now where we've got personalized information and advertising that's more of a nuisance than anything else. And I think the creepiness factor that a lot of people feel when they find out that some of these tools exist and that they're being used all the time, you feel pretty creeped out. But that sense of feeling creeped out is quickly replaced with the immediate gratification of seeing your child's face and a bunch of people reacting to it on Facebook. My feeling is that I want my kids to have as much control over their future digital destiny as possible. And from my point of view, that means keeping them off for as long as possible. Once you're scanned, once your face is in there, the more that you populate these systems, obviously the better they work, but then the more problematic that becomes for you in the long run.
Amy, as you mentioned, you see that the internet and technology in general will become less anonymous. If this is the case and people can't sort of hide in the background, hide behind a screen name, or hide behind an anonymous picture, do you see a number of people withdrawing from the technology?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. One of the ways that we map emerging trends is that we look for a point of backlash. So typically what will happen is we'll get to a point where there's a critical mass of people who get really excited about using something, and then we start to see the antithesis of that. So a good example of this is Facebook rose to the sort of global dominance, and so did Twitter. The idea of having your name attached to social media and sort of being your own publication, right, became very popular. And then we got overwhelmed. And so 2 years ago, one of the trends had to do with ephemeral content, which is content that is shared on a different kind of social network, which appears and then disappears right away. And so that's Snapchat, right? What we then saw happening was the rise of anonymous content. So not just having it be ephemeral, so it disappears right away, but now anonymous and ephemeral. And after that, now what we're seeing is the continued sort of rise of anonymous internet gangs who band together. One of our trends for this year is internet mobs. We saw this happen last year with Cecil the Lion, which was that dentists had shot a lion and had posed with it, and it incensed people not just in the United States but all over the world. He wound up with hate mail. There were these organized communities that gathered online anonymously to make real-world threats. You know, that was just a dentist. That was just a guy. You know, who's to say that that's not going to happen to any number of people? And then this is certainly what's happening within the corporate space as well. I don't mean to get everybody too excited or terrified or to paint the sort of dystopian picture of the future, but there, you know, this is a reality. And the reality is that we no longer live in a world where there's a one-to-many messaging platform or, say, newspaper, right, that is printing stuff to a bunch of people, we live in an omnidirectional world where anybody can post anything, anonymous or not, that information can be scraped by anybody, it can be used by anybody. Everything is sort of free game, which can be problematic, but can also present some interesting opportunities.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Amy Webb, founder and CEO of Webb Media Group. I'm Carol Castiel, and joining me on the program is Rick Pantaleo, science reporter in VOA's English division, and Rick also produces the monthly Science Edition Press Conference USA. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to Kagiri Danson from Kigali, Rwanda. If you want to hear your name on the show, send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Well, Amy Webb, you know, as I was mentioning all of our social media platforms, it just, you know, reminds me I'm out there. You know, and it's good because we need these platforms to publicize our programs. But as you said, there are problems associated with that as well. And one of the trends we've seen the last few years, and that is that terrorist groups or others with malintent are using social media platforms. And we know that ISIS, also known as ISIL, has been very successful in using social media in recruiting and for propaganda efforts. And some critics of social media companies like Twitter and Facebook argue that these companies need to do a better job of monitoring or even banning these groups from using their services. You may recall Democratic presidential frontrunner Hillary Clinton even called for greater efforts in this regard, saying that we must deny these groups what she called, quote, virtual territory, as well as actual territory. Do you agree with her in that regard? And what are these companies doing in order to fend off the use of these platforms for nefarious purposes?
Well, at the end of 2015, Germany put new rules into place prohibiting hate speech. And Twitter, Google, and Facebook agreed to comply, which is to say that if there's any, you know, harassment, and the details around this are pretty stringent, that the conversations are to be blocked or to be banned, and the members are to be banned. And that's really the first time that we've seen any official movement like that and any compliance with technology companies. And it has a lot of people very concerned because, on the one hand, you know, I think that there's a real coherent argument to be made around regulating hate speech. On the other hand, if you're trying to live in a sort of free speech democratic society, then the idea is you don't ban any speech. When it comes to technology and terrorism, though, you know, I find it fascinating to hear politicians all around the world in the United States make remarks about the use of social media or any media and any technology and how it should be regulated. And then at the same time, I see them making really strange decisions with regards to how they themselves are using technology. So I happen to know that there are a few governments around the world that use a platform called Slack. Slack is a really useful messaging system. In fact, we use it. Slack is a great replacement for email. It makes life a lot easier. You know, it's also not 1,000% secure. They promise encryption and a bunch of other things, but I don't know if I want the highest echelons of government using a proprietary system like Slack. And so to me, what this says is oftentimes we wait until something bad has happened and then we try to regulate versus engaging the tech community from the beginning and working in collaboration towards some kind of solution. And I'll give you another example. There's something called CRISPR-Cas9. CRISPR is a new technology that allows scientists to edit at the gene line, for example, with mosquitoes. Mosquitoes that carry malaria and are a real problem in parts of Africa and the Southeast Asia, it's impossible to completely eradicate the mosquito populations. In addition to it just being really hard to do that, you know, it would completely mess up the ecosystem. So instead, this technology allows you to edit part of the genomic structure of the mosquito so that they no longer carry malaria, right? So this becomes a life-saving, life-altering solution. But you can use that same technology to engineer a teeny tiny pig. And in fact, that's happened in China. And these teeny tiny cute pigs have gone on sale, but they are pigs that have been invented by human beings. They've been edited. They'd published a paper on this. They say that they think they can clone a person using some of that same technology. Everybody gets really upset once the announcement's made. There is absolutely no reason why we can't have meaningful conversations at the beginning of the process. And the people who are charged with having those conversations around ethics, who are in charge of, you know, legislating and teaching and financing, you know, all these new technologies, they ought to be concerned well before they read the headlines in the newspapers and magazines and hear it on their televisions and radios.
Amy, as we see and hear about upgrades to technology as far as devices, protocols, and new systems are concerned, that since the internet is international in context, that it's going to be inevitable that international politics is going to have to get into the mix to regulate and keep things on an even flow. Your thoughts?
I mean, yes, I agree with you.
I mean, and what kind of role will their actions have on what's being developed?
Yeah, and again, I think that this goes, you know, to the announcement that was made end of last year from the EU with regards to data. So part of the press release attempted to make the argument that somehow this was going to be good for business and it would increase productivity and help people be more creative and inventive because the regulations would be clear. You know, and most of the common literature out there and just sort of common sense would dictate that the more restrictions that you impose, the less creativity oftentimes you wind up with. So again, this stuff is difficult. It's really difficult to create legislation and rules around technology. The difference is, I don't think anybody who's not an economist would try to come up with economic policy for a country, right? Like, I wouldn't try to do that. But I also don't intersect every day with economic white papers, right? I'm not a quant. On the other hand, everybody interacts with technology. Everybody has some kind of phone, and many people have access to a computer. And therefore, many people, as a result of that, feel like they have enough of a background to give input on what they think the future of technology should be. I don't think that's the right mindset.
Indeed. Well, Amy, following on this combating terrorism on the internet, what are your thoughts about groups like Anonymous, which has recently declared a cyber war on ISIS?
The premise of Anonymous is quite interesting to me. You know, these are people who ostensibly have enough technological know-how and have our public interest at heart, that they are working outside the usual parameters in order to affect good in society. The challenge is that, much like every best-laid set of plans, the implementation is where things fall apart. And so, you know, Anonymous has promised to go after these terrorist groups. Anonymous, or at least people saying that they were part of Anonymous, also went after the Ku Klux Klan several months ago in the United States and threatened to out members of this white supremacist group. And they got a lot of them wrong. So they included people on this list who, there's no way that many of these people are KKK members. You know, the challenge is that messages spread quickly. And so rather than taking down or at least shining a light on this hate group, instead, we wound up with a lot of misinformation, and local media outlets in the United States covered the list, even though the list had not obviously been verified. And now you wind up with, you know, a few dozen people who have to deal with this. So like I said, you know, I think in theory, using digital tools against digital tools, right, makes sense. The challenge is when it crosses over into digital vigilantism, which is what we're seeing, unfortunately, a lot of.
Right. And just quickly summarizing your view on what the big tech companies should be doing, such as Google and Apple, in order to deprive these terrorist groups of the virtual territory they're using to promote their heinous propaganda and recruiting.
I don't know that Google and Apple have a legal obligation to do anything.
How about the moral obligation?
Again, I think this comes down to collaboration. I don't think that any government can say to any tech company or any corporation, you deal with this, right? This is your problem now, which is essentially the implications. Instead, we need to see stronger and more meaningful collaborations, and it can't just be about currying favor one way or the other, or occasional lobbying. There are plenty of people that work within governments and within technology companies who want to see us emerge at the end of 2016 in a better world than we're in right now, right? And I think most people would want that. So the challenge is to get those people to the table working collaboratively.
Amy, if you were to pick one aspect or one issue or one trend in your list for the current year, what do you think will be the one trend that will have the greatest impact?
I would say in North America, the trend that will probably impact most people are drones. For one thing, we're going to see a lot more of them overhead. Drones will do much more than they could. So in addition to just delivering packages, they'll also help reach remote areas for residents who maybe can't get mail easily or prescription drugs. So I think unmanned vehicles throughout North America and also parts of Europe will be a big trend, and it will be something that will impact everybody. Don't forget these drones also have cameras. They're required to help you drive them. So that means you're potentially on camera as well. I would say that that's a big one. And part of that is, at least in the United States, and probably elsewhere soon, drone lanes. So we have individuals who have drones, we have corporations who have drones, and these drones need to do different things. So we'll probably have sort of invisible highways in the sky pretty soon where these drones will be able to operate. For areas around Africa, Europe, I think that bots will probably have a pretty big impact in the coming year.
Let's define bots.
Yeah, let's get...
Yep. So bots are little sort of robots that run on their own. They're automated applications or tasks, and they do things that people would have done previously. So as an example, there are bots that automate mailings from banks. There are bots that do surveillance. There are bots that human resource managers can use to help them train employees. There are also bots that are meant to be companions. So Microsoft has an experimental Mandarin language bot, and for those who've seen the movie Her, it's very similar to Samantha, which was the operating system. And, you know, this experimental bot lives inside of a smartphone, and it has a conversation with the consumer, with the user. So I think that we're going to start to see more of that, bots as companions going forward.
Well, I use Uber, which was big, and it has been now, I think, around the world, these private driving company
ride system.
But I'd like to make a plug for human beings. They use a lot of GPS, and sometimes that takes them astray. So I think, too, we might want to bring back maps. And also just using common sense. How's that?
And instructions
on
how to fool
me. Actually, you made a great point, and that is, you know, if you stop and think about it, most people have lost the ability to lose their way and then to navigate themselves back. And there really is something occasionally useful in getting lost. And most people around the world no longer have that as an option.
Believe me, some of the GPS systems help you get lost.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I appreciate that. And on a final note, Amy, you're going to have a book coming out later this year. How did we miss that? Give us a preview.
I did. I'm not entirely sure if that's the final title, but it comes out December 6th. It is a look into what the future holds with regards to lots of different sectors, from self-driving cars to biohacking yourself. And more importantly, it's also an explanation of how you can do that yourself. So I don't mind doing my trend report every year and talking to people about trends, but I do think for everybody's sake, it's important for lots of people to do what I do and to continually think about the future and to plan accordingly for it.
And before we close, Amy, just a word about your book, Data, A Love Story. It's a best-selling memoir about finding love via algorithms. I think many of our listeners, including myself, would like to hear about that.
Sure. I can quickly summarize it by saying I had lived overseas for a while, and when I came back to the United States, I was eager to not go out on any more bad dates. And so I tried online dating, and in that process discovered that online dating systems really are broken. They're asking the wrong things. So I created my own system, and I sort of reverse engineered the online dating site that I used and figured out how the system worked and then how to make the system work for me. And I met my husband that way. And after everything that I did, and it was a sort of data-driven system, he was the last first date I ever went out on.
Wow.
And we've been married for 7 years.
Amazing.
Well, Amy, stay on the line. I'll be talking with you about that after the show.
Okay.
Amy Webb is founder and CEO of Webb Media Group. Thanks so much, Amy, for your time and terrific insights.
Thank you so much.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Keith Holmes. And joining me on the program was Rick Pantaleo, science reporter in VOA's English division and author of the ever-popular Science World blog. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.